Hello, this is Christopher Bandini, one of the co-hosts of New Books in Psychoanalysis, and I'm here today with John Sletfold, PsyD, and we're going to talk about his book, The Embodied Analyst. Dr. Sletfold is a licensed specialist in clinical psychology and psychotherapy. He was founding board director of the Norwegian Character Analytic Institute and is currently faculty training and supervising analyst at the Character Analytic Institute. He is former chair of the Psychotherapy Specialty Board of the Norwegian Psychological Association. He has published articles particularly on the role of the body in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis in national and international journals and is co-editor of two books, Den Therapeutiske Dansen, The Therapeutic Dance, and Character Analytic Dialogues. I'm not going to try that other pronunciation. He is the author of The Embodied Analyst, From Freud and Reich to Relationality, published by Routledge, Taylor, and Francis in the Relational Books Perspective Series 2014, and is the winner of the Godiva Award 2015. So welcome, Dr. Sletfold.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
What I would like to start, and what is customary in starting these interviews, is to speak about what caused you to write the book, why you thought it would be a good topic.
That's actually one question I am a bit prepared for, as you told me that you usually start that way. I will start with saying that from the middle of the 90th, I started working on two ideas points of view or positions. The one had to do with the character analytic work of Wilhelm Reich, formulated in the late 20th and early 30s. And the other thing was the new relational psychoanalysis, formulated not least by Stephen Mitchell. I became preoccupied with trying to integrate these two traditions. The early work on character analysis from Reich, I think, was an early attempt to create the bodily basis for psychoanalysis, and that was not the main focus of Mitchell. That was more the relationship, no. But I found that they had an important thing common. They both took as their starting point that the basic conflict is between the individual, the person, and the outer world, the environment, rather than inborn conflicting drives.
And you felt this had disappeared or vanished maybe previously and had to be kind of restated in some way, or was it something that was missing?
When you,
the use of the body, the body, yeah, in psychoanalysis.
Yes. And I had for quite some years been interested in the place of the body in psychoanalysis and psychotherapy. I started working with integrating these two ideas and found that that seemed to function quite well. So by the middle of the, around 2005, I had published some of this work in Norwegian, but none internationally and in English. So I started working with an English paper, which resulted in two papers in psychoanalytic dialogues, one on the on Wilhelm Reich and the history of embodied analysis, and one on embodied approaches to analytic training. So those two papers, in a way, was the starting point for the book.
The use of the word embodied is an interesting word. Can you say a little more about it and why you chose that term?
I think it's a term that an English term, English language term. We don't have it in Norwegian or in German. So, but in FA, it felt like a good term, and it was also a term that was starting to be used more. I think like embodied cognition, and also in psychoanalysis.
So the sense of the analyst being in his body, being more embodied, more in the body rather than in the mind.
Yes, that and the analyst being in the body, that's important, which is another perspective than looking primarily at the patient's body.
And there's many interesting things in the book. I really enjoyed reading it. But certainly the history of Reich, I think you did it very concisely, and it was kind of one of the really interesting chapters about what he was like and what his contributions were. And again, we know about Reich, but we don't think about his work until really your book, I think, has brought it back.
I hope so. And I think Reich has been best known for his, or more known for his later work, which came into focus particularly after he moved to the USA, where the ergonomy, the physical work with the body, and also more cosmological theories, which are at least disputable. So what I have found particularly important or valuable in Reich is his early psychoanalytic work from the middle of the 20th. Which then he termed character analysis, and said that it had to do primarily with changing the focus from the what, which was the what the patient told, to how the patient communicates and tells about things, which then leads to more the emotional expression of the body, and how we walk, how we sit, how we stand.
Yes, like character armor is the kind of the patient is embodied in this armor, right?
Then we move to that's about an embodied view of the defense, that we don't only use the mind in our psychological defense, but we also use our body. And the armor is a metaphor that he used, and it's, should we say, it captures one aspect. We can tighten our bodies, but we do also a lot of other things. We move towards each other, away from each other, against each other. So it's also very much about how we move our body. When we talk about the defensive side of our being,
how did Reich get interested in the body? Why was it? Why do you think it was his innovation rather than maybe? Why did Freud maybe disregard it or not pay attention to it, and Reich did?
It's a complicated question, and I must also remind us that the title of the book or the subtitle is "From Freud and Reich to Relationality." And I think Freud, particularly in his earliest days, did very important work on the body.
Okay, which I stand
also
corrected.
Yes, and he also came back to the body, particularly in The Ego and the Id, 1923. But he did not really develop an embodied approach to therapy, to the clinical analysis. That there he stayed mostly with the symbolic, as we know. So, as I read and understand Reich, I don't think it in the start was a question of a special interest in the body. It might have been, but I'm not sure about that. But what he was detecting was that focused on the non-verbalized resistances, the so-called negative transference, and that the resistances was not expressed only or mostly through things the patient said, but very much in the way the patient behaved. So I think it was his work on developing the psychoanalytic technique that, in a way, drew him through the bodily expressions. One of his first responsibilities from rather early in the 20th was that he first initiated and then led what was called the Seminar on Technique in Vienna, comprising Freud's closest circle.
Why do you think he shifted more? I mean, as you mentioned earlier, that his later work is more well known. Do you know anything about why he shifted in his work from to the organ box and kind of organ therapy and what happened there?
When you ask me what made him shift, I must say I really am not sure. To me, it's in many ways a mysterious thing. But he was, he became very preoccupied with his conviction that the neurosis was something that was very grounded in the body. And that made him think in the direction of biophysics. So for Reich, his later work on ergonomy was biophysics. It was not psychology. It was not psychoanalysis. But it was not character analysis, even though he said that this more psychological part of the work still was important. But what he thought was really revolutionary about his later work was that it went beyond psychology and into biophysics and also pure physics in a way. So he was very excited at the moment when it seemed like the great physicist,
not Einstein.
Einstein, yes, yes. When Einstein seemed to be interested in his work, but it was very short-lived.
Also, moving on, something that I didn't know about was this kind of strong Norwegian tradition that you write about in the book, and some of the pioneers there. Would you care to speak about some of them and maybe some of the contributions that the Norwegian psychoanalysts made?
Yeah, I would like to do that, and of course that is the background why I became concerned with the learned about these things in the Norwegian tradition. The person that I write most about I think is the most important is Harald Schjelderup, who was the first Norwegian professor of psychology. Initially was professor of philosophy, and then he became professor of psychology, and he trained in psychoanalysis in Vienna and in Zurich. So he was a psychoanalyst from the late 20th. And he he became interested in the work of Reich. He must have heard about it in Vienna when he was there, I think. So when Reich first moved in 33 from Berlin to Denmark, Schjelderup contacted him and started an analysis with him, and shortly afterward also invited Reich to Oslo in 1934 and gave him opportunity to teach at the psychology department at the University of Oslo. But it turned out that Schjelderup early on developed his own independent position. He did not share the view of either Freud nor Reich on sexuality as the only source of neurosis. He developed in many ways a very contemporary view, stressing that all kinds of traumatic experiences and bad forms of upbringing could result in neurotic problems. So, so he has meant quite a lot to me, but also the Reich's foremost Danish student, which I also write a little about, Tage Philipson. He he was the teacher of my training analyst. So that's my
the analytic family.
That's that's the lion of my analytic family. Which he particularly developed views on embodied identification, which resonates with many of the contemporary views stimulated by the mirror neurons and that kind of bodily foundation for intersubjectivity.
Before, when you heard about Mitchell and I guess Greenberg and Mitchell, how were analysts practicing in Norway? And was this a large shift, do you think, or did only some analysts move towards relational work, or how did that manifest itself in Norway?
I don't think we have had any broad, relational movement actually in Norway. I had a relational leaning from the start. Actually, I was about to become a social psychologist before I I went into the clinical world and gradually into psychoanalysis. But there were definite exceptions. But in the IPA Institute in Norway, I think the relational tradition until recently has not had a very strong position. There has been another institute which had been affiliated with the White Institute here in New York, which has had a clear relational orientation. And also my institute, the Character Analytic Institute, which in a way was formed on the basis of this merger or integration of character analysis and relational psychoanalysis.
You have several chapters in the book on, I guess, embodied subjectivity and embodied intersubjectivity. Would you care to kind of speak about them, maybe the differences or the similarities or how you came up with those terms and why you wrote about them?
I think those terms are fruits of this integration of relational psychoanalysis and the body-based character analysis. So the terms subjectivity and intersubjectivity, you know, they became very popular within. Both self-psychology, the new relational psychology, the interpersonal psychoanalysis, the focus on subjectivity and intersubjectivity. So for me, it became rather natural, as I shared these views also on subjectivity, to try to add the embodied dimension. Because I, in my view, these positions, the subjectivity, the feeling of myself, and intersubjectivity, the feeling of you in me, they are all both grounded in embodied experience, in my view. I feel myself in my own body, but in a way I also feel you in my own body through identification, imitation, and so on. And actually also Freud wrote about this.
Please remind me.
Then I must look up this chapter on intersubjectivity. This is Freud. A path leads from identification by way of imitation to empathy.
That was one thing that really struck me was the embodiment of empathy. Now we think about empathy and maybe in a sense of imagining putting ourselves in someone else's shoes, but I think you do a great job on adding this kind of embodied sense of empathy.
I'm happy to hear that that's your impression, because I think that's one of my main focuses.
I think it comes across very clearly.
Oh, good, yes. Good, good.
Yes. Mm. And how is there a way that an embodied analysis would look differently? Does this affect in any way, or maybe you think, feel it should affect how we work with patients in terms of maybe the frame or the office or how we are in the room with patients? Does it look different?
I discuss some of those topics in the book. When it comes to the frame and to the office, I discuss it particularly, I think, in the last chapter. I think that traditionally psychoanalysis and psychotherapy has been done in very fixed forms. Psychoanalysis lying down, the analyst sitting behind, and other forms of psychotherapy usually sitting in two chairs. And I think none of these arrangements has been much discussed traditionally. It's been either you do psychoanalysis that way or you do psychotherapy that way. So from my experience, and I think it's important to focus on how we are impacted, both patient and analyst, in different ways by how we are with each other. And the impact is different for different patients and of course, truly also different analysts. So I think it's important to have a discussion and to be conscious about it. Simple examples, which I also elaborate on in the book, is that for some patients, laying down can be quite traumatic.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And for others, sitting, looking at each other can be very traumatic.
Yes. Right. You have to make a decision on a case-by-case basis. Each person is different.
Yes. And also in different phases of the same analysis.
Yes.
Mm. That's my view.
And we seem to have maybe what you're saying is it's been a one-size-fits-all, or we've been thinking we kind of apply it across the board, and we have to have maybe more flexibility about this than we've had in the past.
That's my argument, yeah.
Also, you do a wonderful job of integrating the different concepts besides empathy, like attachment theory and some of the new neuroscience. Would you like to say something about that as well?
Yeah, but what should I say?
How does the attachment maybe come into this, the attachment theories?
I feel they fit rather well into my basic relational orientation. And to me, it seems that this is an experience I share with many contemporary psychoanalysts and psychotherapists. There was some decades ago I think quite the microanalytic infant research by Stern, Bibi, and others was seen as something quite different from Bowlby and the attachment. Over the years, I think it seems to me that these perspectives has grown very much together.
Well, it's certainly you couldn't get any more embodied than the mother-infant dyad,
no,
I think.
No, and no. And well, of course, that's an important important point. All the focus, the research and interest in the infant caregiver situation, I think has been contributed much to moving psychoanalysis in an embodied direction. So that also has helped very much this integration that I write about. For instance, the work of Bibi and Lachmann, the book they published in 2002, that fitted very well into the training program that we were creating at the Character Analytic Institute, I remember.
Hmm. So that's also, I guess, in the later chapters of the book, you mentioned the training, and maybe maybe you can discuss some of the aspects of how you might how the training might differ, or what you might add to supervision, what you might ask to the training of new analysts.
Yeah, I think that's a very important part of the work.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
And it's also a part of the history of the book, so to speak, that I, in these years, together with colleagues, were engaged in developing a new form of training, and embodied analytic training. What early on became important aspect of this training was that we developed ways of working with the patient without words. We came up with a way of presenting the patient in case conferences without telling anything about the patient. Instead, asking the candidate who would present the patient to start just by standing in the way he or she would imagine the patient would stand, and later on walking and sitting down like the patient. This turned out to be very fruitful. And because then all candidate students focused very much on bodily behavior of the imitated patient and forgot about the history of the patient, that they didn't know anything about it. In my experience, knowing a lot about verbally about the patient brings about much of the preconceptions of the candidates and has a tendency to turn interest away from what is actually going on with the patient. So I think we have profited very much from this starting with just how the patient appears bodily.
It's almost like it borrows from almost like a like theater or acting to kind of to get into that place.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I've particularly been fascinated with the work of a friend of late Daniel Stern, Robert Wilson, who actually uses very much the same technique when he directs actors in a play, having them to create the characters with only the body first and then putting on the words later.
How do the supervisees respond to this technique?
I think in supervision we allow some words, but not too many words. And then we have the supervisees to enter both the analyst position and the patient position bodily. Generally, candidates, supervisees are very happy with this this approach. One aspect of it is that it focuses on the unconscious experiences in the candidate's body, and brings that out in a way that quite automatically feels helpful. That's because it comes from the candidate rather than the correct ideas coming from the supervisor.
The concept of imitation that you mentioned is very important here. That's also mentioned earlier in the book. Yes,
very basic. Yeah, when it comes to how we learn about the other one, about the patient.
It's a basic kind of human interaction that you kind of elucidate and elaborate on in the book, that imitation is kind of basic to human interaction, human contact.
Yeah. We were struck early in this work by how powerful our ability to imitate is. So maybe we are thinking that it's only particularly gifted actors that has this ability, but I think most of us have it. And there are also a lot of research over the recent years that support that imitation is very basic to human functioning.
What about countertransference and kind of how some of the things you write about might factor in or might change the way we think about countertransference?
Change it, or perhaps
add to it,
underline it even more. In a way, I think for a great part of the history, the history of psychoanalysis over the last decades is about the shift from transference to countertransference, more on what's going on in the analyst and the analyst's ability to have knowledge and use knowledge about the patient. And this more explicit, embodied conception of a countertransference, I think it's more underlines and hopefully contributes to a strengthening of this development. So lately I've been writing about psychoanalysis as a work from the analyst's body. So in more traditional terms, that would be work from the countertransference.
Something that's also interesting that you write about is companionship. And there was an interesting piece also about, I guess, companionship, obviously, with other people, but also companionship with animals, you mentioned.
Yeah. I must say that the term companionship I borrow from Tjevarten. Yeah. That's not my creation, but I liked it. I add a little bit about companionship with animals. And the reason is that it has struck me with several patients that relationship to animals, particularly dogs, seem to have played an important part.
Not against the cat people, but specifically dogs.
Yeah. And not about not against the cat people.
Nothing against cats.
In my case, it's usually just been dogs. And I think there are some important differences, probably also between cats and dogs in this respect.
Right.
Yeah. So I think that many people who had very, very unhappy in many ways or not so good relationship with their parents and with the humans, they do better when they have had the opportunity to attach to a dog. And I speculate also that it contributes to the development of empathy.
Yes, it's something that in many cases we hear from our patients, but it hasn't been written about widely.
No. I don't write very much about it, but I have a short part, and you were fascinated by it.
It was interesting to me to kind of run across it. But one thing I was thinking of, and this is something, maybe it's just my own take, but when I go to the conferences, you know, we go to these conferences and we sit in these large hotel rooms and we listen to the talks, but we never move around. And I was thought about that when I was reading your book about how wonderful it would be if all of us moved more.
You know,
maybe if we moved in the session or if we moved during the conferences, like the conferences should have like, you know, a masseuse there or a kind of a dance a possibility or something where people should just break to stretch and go to yoga or something. I think about how much that was something I thought about when I was reading your book of how little we move when we're working.
Yeah. I think there can be some changes. There are some changes. I think there has been some small movement exercises in a couple of conferences lately.
Oh, have there?
I think I remember. But you are right, and I think it reflects the psychoanalytic tradition. You find it outside psychoanalysis also. I think other conferences can be very much the same. That could go back to what I also write a little about building on the work of Sue Shapiro, how the body was disciplined in a way in the Western culture in the 19th century. But back to psychoanalysis. So there was the conviction that it was important not to move, not to act.
Yes.
because that was considered
almost like to move would be like to get away from neutrality, like to not move was considered neutral.
Yeah, I think that's right. But also it was considered as the best way to make the unconscious conscious, and I think that was a mistake.
I mean, I think to go back to the countertransference piece, you know, the desire to move around and or to feel fidgety or to feel something in the body when with the patient is kind of some of our most useful clues as to what's going on.
Definitely.
And to kind of try to restrain that seems to be kind of an error to make.
Yeah, I agree with you. Hmm.
Let me see if there's some other things that I haven't spoken about, something else we can add, any aspect of the book that I'm thinking of that we haven't covered.
Oh, yeah. So we have touched the main topics, I think. But
I think so. Another thing I was thinking of was I guess there's more of a tradition in the body other body work or creative arts therapy of using the body more than
Definitely. I have some experiences from these traditions. Particularly, I worked for many years and studied with an American, Albert Pesso, who was originally a dancer and who created a form of psychodramatic group psychotherapy based on his experiences with the training dancers. And that has been a very important experience for me, to somehow see the move, see the body move, and learn the importance and of the movements of the body and how expressive it is.
Which I guess brings me to another point, which is maybe if you could say a few words about how this work informs maybe some of the current literature on trauma and kind of the current work on trauma and how we can perhaps integrate this as well.
Yeah, that was a big question.
It is a big question.
Yeah. I think that, actually all non-neurological mental disorders has, in one way or another, a traumatic background. There are so many ways of being traumatized and mm-hmm. to develop defenses against trauma. So that's, in a way, the forms very much of the basics of my understanding, and it goes back to the view that our basic conflicts and also possibilities has to do with the relationship with each other and the environment. So I will publish a paper in Psychoanalytic Dialogues, probably the next edition, on Freud's, what I call Freud's three theories of neurosis, and suggest that his first theory on trauma and defense has turned out to be right, and that we could build a contemporary theory on that early trauma theory of Freud. So all clinical analysis, all psychotherapy is, in my view, a way of treating trauma. But there are several views on this, and other people will reserve trauma to more dramatic events in life. But very much, also research points in the direction that that maybe some of the most traumatic experiences for us is the distorted emotional communication, not between, not least between infants and, and caregivers, and that the impact of what we could call empathic deficits seem to be as great as are the impacts of major abuse and neglect.
So I just wanted to say, I guess we're going to have a few more minutes and we're going to finish up, but just how great it was to speak with you about this book. I think it's a really essential book.
And
that how I wanted to also add about how you sometimes we do these interviews on Skype, and how you really made a great point of saying, no, I'm going to come in person and do it. So we're sitting in my office doing this because I had forgotten about the embodied part of it. Here I am doing an interview about the embodied analyst, and I'm saying, let's do it on the phone.
Yeah.
And you made this great point of coming in and saying, let's do it in person. So here we are in person in New York City. Yeah. Doing it. So I just wanted to thank you for that and kind of reminding me about the body as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so if that's all, I guess we'll...
Thank you.
That's great. I think it was a great interview. Thank you. And this is Christopher Bandini with John Slethfold from New Books in Psychoanalysis. Until next time.